Okay, so the next person to be joining us for lunch is, I'm very proud to say, our endorsed candidate for the Pennsylvania Democratic Lieutenant Gubernatorial primary, and the winner of that election. And I think, I'm not sure how you would feel about it, but I definitely want the Young Democrats to take all the credit, although you guys did campaign.
I'm willing to run with it, yeah.
Okay. I mean, you do have Young Democrats running your race with you, so I don't think any of us really need to do much of an introduction. You are well known in Pennsylvania. Did a fantastic job running in 16. You're doing a fantastic job running this year. We look forward to having you serve as the president of the Senate, knock on wood. So thank you for joining us for lunch and for letting us have you on the Delco Young Democast.
All right. I'm here to say you're all young and naive, right? No, this is it's so great to be back here, and as you mentioned, I was so truly honored to have your endorsement. Honestly, it meant the world, and I'm sure you've also seen that Pennsylvania leads the country in youth voter registration increases. I mean, like, that's amazing. No, like, seriously. You know, any room I walk into and I see a Steeler hat and a Fetterman shirt, you know, it's gonna be a good day right there. You know, no. The only thing that could be better is if he had a Sheetz card in his pocket. Okay. Sorry. I thought you guys liked authenticity. I'm trying to be real. Wawa's great. I just, you know. But Odie's got a Wawa cup to mock me, no less. But all kidding aside, honestly, like, I am truly honored to be here, and I so appreciate everything. What, you know, like, the hope you guys give me, honestly. You know, you have a president that is normalizing racial animosity in a way that's unprecedented. Calling NFL athletes son of bitches, calling an African-American woman a dog. Today you had a Georgia state senator saying it wouldn't bother him if he didn't call, you know, if he didn't use the N-word. I mean, like, this, you know, we are through the looking glass on so many things that in any one thing in an isolated incident. I give this example. I remember when Al Gore, when he was debating George Bush for the first time, sighed, you know, like an annoyed sigh. And that cost him votes, and that was a scandal. Like, how dare he? You know, this is crazy. And today, now you have the leader of the free world tweeting insults at cable hosts and wanting to host a military-style parade where they march with giant missiles down the center of the road. It's crazy. And the only reason it's not happening is because it's going to cost $92 million. You know, $92 million to have some bizarre military parade when we have Pennsylvanians that can't afford their own prescription drugs, or they can't afford to pay for their electric bill. They can't afford to keep up with their student debt. They can't afford just the basic needs of living, let alone thriving. I can't even describe it. And it all gets renewed through you guys and the efforts that you guys bring to the table. And, you know, I'm so grateful to have your support. I can just speak to the things that matter a lot to me. And the things that matter a lot to me are marginalized communities. I've represented a marginalized community for four terms as mayor. And whether it's racially marginalized, geographically marginalized, environmentally marginalized, economically marginalized, you know, I'm proud to say that I've been mayor there since 2005, and I've really, really also proud of being the first elected official in Pennsylvania to solemnize a same-sex wedding when it was illegal in Pennsylvania, if you can imagine that, in 2013 to do that. So in terms of progress, what I want to do if I'm your next lieutenant governor is, you know, I want to help bring along and facilitate criminal justice reform. As chair of the Board of Pardons, you know, it's 2018, and do you know the application isn't digitized? It's not online anywhere. I mean, that's an extraordinary statement. It's not easily, it's not accessible. It's all these things. And another thing that's deeply troubling is that the vote has to be unanimous. You know, it used to be majority rule, and now it's unanimous. I think, extremely cruel to have a process that exists theoretically, but to make that bar so high, it makes it so rare, and it makes it nearly impossible to deliver on this idea that we are the party of second chances. We are the party that believes that we don't believe in death by incarceration. We're the party that doesn't want to criminalize things like marijuana, small-scale marijuana possessions. We don't want to criminalize. We want to get rid of cash bail where it's appropriate, so we don't criminalize poverty. We don't criminalize race. We don't, like, all these things that are wrong with our criminal justice system right now. We really need to get to a point where we stand. I mean, to me, I've said this online many times. Decency's on the ballot in 2018. Decency's on the ballot. And you have opponents, you know, I had a lot of fun at Scott Wagner's expense, you know, going through the Young and Naive episode. And it is remarkable that video generated 6 million views. You know, that's like, you know, like Taylor Swift popular. And because Scott doesn't have that natural magnetism otherwise. But at 6... I kid Scott, but it was such an authentic moment for him, because this young activist was confronting him about climate change and the science that is behind it, and he dismissed her based solely on her age, and his pushback was, it's caused by body heat. And it's caused by the Earth just randomly, you know, drifting closer to the sun. I mean, that's remarkable that a man running for the highest office in Pennsylvania, you know, up until he realized that crazy doesn't poll well, changed his tune. He thought that, you know, our climate is changing because there are more people living on this Earth, and our body heat was causing that. And he had the audacity to call a young person naive for pushing back and confronting them on that. And I think that was a powerful moment. In 2018, I'm so proud to be Governor Wolf's running mate, because if you care about it in Pennsylvania as a Democrat, Scott Wagner wants to repeal it, he wants to stop it, he wants to outlaw it, and he wants to make it go away in a manner that I don't really see it bringing back. You know, rhetoric question, who here believes unions have a right to exist and organize? Yeah. You know, Democrat 101. Scott Wagner, if he wins, takes Pennsylvania right to work the next day. I'm sure the legislation's already written up. I mean, that's like top of the wish list. Can you imagine that? Pennsylvania's the fifth largest state in the country, and if he wins that election, it goes right to work, you know, the first month he's in office. Who here has a casual glancing interest in women's reproductive health care? Yeah. Scott Wagner, again, has openly stated that it's out of here if he is elected governor. I mean, can you imagine that? That it would be illegal to secure an abortion in Pennsylvania. I mean, that's on the ballot. That's on the ballot this year. And that's not a scare tactic. That's not a way to drum up participation. That's the reality. Public education. You know, Tom Corbett cut more than $1 billion out of public education. Scores and graduation rates plummeted. My running mate fixed that, and scores and graduation rates are back up to a respectable level now. Again, it's all on the line with respects to public education. Environmental issues. My running mate created the first LGBTQ commission in the entire country 2 weeks ago. And that's what I mean when I say decency is on the ballot here. You know, and you know, Scott Wagner would want to take all of that away. And we all know, because we're all really, you know, despite being naive, we're all really activated, and we're all understand that Hillary Clinton lost by 44,000 votes in 2016, and we can't let that happen again. You know, I, to my horror, woke up the next morning and was like, I can't believe, I can't process this. Who here has been even more, you know, we all had low standards and expectations when Donald Trump was elected, but like, it hasn't even gotten remotely close. I mean, like, close to that. Like, it's so much worse than I thought it would be, you know? So much crazier. So much more divisive. So much meaner. And in Pennsylvania, Scott Wagner wants to do that same thing. And that's why our philosophy as a campaign is every county, every vote, every door. And that energy is coming from you guys. We run off the energy that you guys produce that doesn't add to the body, to climate change. It runs to the enthusiasm that you guys are willing to knock on doors. You guys are willing to engage. You guys are willing to say, this is not the country that I want to inherit. You know, I just celebrated my 49th birthday this week. You know, when I was my campaign manager's age, you know, things were a lot different. And right now we are in, you know, an end game with the Supreme Court nationally, Kavanaugh. You know, when Justice Kennedy, whose retirement made this appointment necessary, was first appointed, I was 18 years old. 18 years old. You know, poison was the top band in America. You know, I had a big yellow Walkman, you know, to listen to music. Yeah, he knows, you know. You know, and again, I like me some poison, don't get me wrong. Still, even, every rose has its thorn. But that gives you an idea of the ramifications of appointing a Supreme Court justice. I'm a 49-year-old man, but when he was appointed, I was an 18-year-old, so Kavanaugh was the same age. Just think, 30 years from now, think of all the decisions, think of all the directions that we could go as a country if he's appointed, and that breaks my heart. You know, and the fight to protect these things like unions and women's reproductive choices is going to be a state's issue, because they are effectively stacking the Supreme Court. And that's why it's so important to win in this election, because the changes that Scott Wagner would undertake in Pennsylvania would be very, very difficult to ever bring back in Pennsylvania. And I just don't want to see that happen. I don't want to see that happen as Governor Wolf's running mate, but most importantly, I don't want to see that happen as a father of three young kids that are going to be sitting and being your age in the next 10 or 15 years. And I don't want to do that as a resident of a state that I love. And that's why I took on this challenge. That's why I'm so grateful to have your support, and have consistently enjoyed your support. You know, there are people in this room that were so kind to me in 2016, even, you know, that supported my campaign. When I was running against, you know, the full party and everything, and because I believed that we needed to take a different look at issues, and I never had to look back on all the things that I ran on and say, geez, why did I come out for a living wage, you know? You know, why did I support legalizing marijuana, you know, across the board? I've never had to look back and say, you know, wow, I shouldn't have been progressive, because I believe in being progressive and I believe in being proud. And if me, those of you that are familiar with me, my wife was a former dreamer. If me denying or renouncing my wife's origin story was required for me to hold office in Pennsylvania, it wouldn't be my time. If I had to say, I don't believe you should love who you love, it's not my time. You know, I will never retreat from core progressive values. But on the other side of that, we are the party of second chances. And I refuse to write off many Trump voters this time either and say, you know what, you voted for someone I don't understand, I could never vote for him, but we are still, I don't want to write them off. Because there are a lot of people that I think regret their vote. I think there are people that are persuadables. I think there's a lot of persuadables in Pennsylvania. If you look at Lackawanna County went for Barack Obama over John McCain by 10 points in 2008. Lackawanna went for Barack Obama over Mitt Romney, you know, the handsome, polite uncle, you know, at Thanksgiving. You know, who's a little conservative but doesn't freak you out, kind of conservative type. Barack Obama beat him by 5 points in Lackawanna County in 2012. Donald Trump carried Lackawanna in 2016 by 20 points. 20 points, okay? That's persuadable. That's people that want to be heard. That's individuals that rolled the dice on a dangerous individual, and that happened in our state, in Wisconsin, and in Michigan. By a sum total of three states of 75,000 votes. We are taking it to all 67 counties, every county, every vote, you know? Now, there are some in the Republican Party that are unreachable, you know? Nationalism, xenophobia, homophobia, just overall, I mean, that's the Southern strategy, right? That's been part of the Republican hardcore base since the Republican parties made it part of their base. But there are people that voted for Donald Trump that I believe are reachable and they are persuadable. And in this case, I'm not leaving anything off the table. You know, we have a message that is unapologetically democratic, unapologetically progressive, but it's also pragmatic, and it's also it also lets anyone that voted that we are the party that's looking out for you. When I'm speaking to union members, it's not a secret that many union members in 2016, voted Donald Trump, voted against their own economic interests. And when I'm talking to whether it's a union member or a room full of union members, I'm saying, like, look, you know, you don't have to agree with us on every social issue. Maybe we don't. I hope we do, but maybe we don't. I'm not going to apologize for my views. I'm not asking you to apologize for yours. But here's one thing that we definitely agree on, and that is you and your family and your community's economic security through collective bargaining, through unions. And we want your support. We want your support so we can deliver for you, okay? And you can't be distracted by the wedge issues, by the division, the divisive issues. And that doesn't mean that we change on what we believe, for example, but it means that we need your vote, and that's what I think 2018 is going to come down to, and there are some people in our party that think that it's all about a new coalition, and we should nurture a new coalition. We should go after those that haven't voted before. We should go after marginalized communities and people. Absolutely. You know, people ask me, can we win? Can we win with just a new coalition? And my response is, why would we want to gamble with that? You know, why would we want to find out? You know, because, you know, two things can be true simultaneously. You know, we need to nurture the new coalition. We need to be actively engaged in reaching out and energizing. And we do have a great message. But we also have to take sure that we don't write off, you know, I mean, Potter County. We're not going to turn Potter County blue anytime soon. But we can't and we shouldn't be losing at 80-20 or 75-25. We have to compete in every county. And that is going to be, in my opinion, how we win, and the youth and the energy that you guys are bringing to the table, and just this idea that it is all on the line in Pennsylvania in 2018. And I know you're going to vote. You're spending, you know, a Saturday, you know, inside talking politics. I know you're going to vote. But it's what you're willing to do above and beyond that is going to, and you know, largely determine it. I think this race is going to come down to counties like Dauphin, where we're in, counties like Erie, counties like Cambria. You know, if those counties are blue, we're good. We're good. So, and that's why I'm here. That's why I've put 60,000 miles on my truck since I started this campaign. Probably end up with close to 80,000, you know. I remember doing Shane's interview, but what was that February?
Yeah, it was
Yeah, February. I've done podcast after podcast, interview after interview, no matter where I'm at in the state, because it matters. It absolutely matters. You know, and it's like, we want to talk to every voter that's reachable in Pennsylvania. And you're the leaders. I'm just bringing up the rear. And I am so grateful for your energy and your support. I'm so grateful for your endorsement. And I'm truly honored to be here. Thank you very much.
Awesome. So, Mayor Fetterman, I think we've got a couple of questions mm-hmm. that we just want to go over real quick, and then we'll open up the floor to a few more questions. I know we want to be respectful of your time.
Oh, no. But if you're respectful of my time, you'll ask me as many questions as you want.
Okay, fair.
This is what I'm here for.
Fair enough. For the show, we always kind of start off asking people kind of their like origin story, more or less. Mm-hmm. When did you basically realize that you were a Democrat? You know, was it one single moment, or was it a series of events, or just kind of a gradual realization?
I think it was more of a gradual realization with a couple life instances that really drove it home. Some of you may not know, I grew up in York. You know, I'm a York County guy. And as you all know, York is not exactly a hotbed of progressive, you know, Democratic politics, you know. And, you know, my family is, I'm really essentially the only Democrat in my family, you know. And it's not like an angry, you know, awful kind of hardcore, extremism. It's just more of a moderate Republican kind of bent. And I had two specific things happen to me in my life that really kind of put me on this path and this idea. First of which was, after graduating business school, I was waiting for my best friend to come pick me up to go to the gym. I was your age, many of your age. Bobby, my campaign manager, is 20, just turned 26. I was 24 at the time. And he never showed up, and I wondered what happened to him. I thought he just blew me off. He was too lazy. Turns out he never made it to my home to pick me up. Is because he was killed on his way over in a car accident to come get me. And I had never lost somebody. I've never been close to that kind of tragedy before. And it got me thinking, and I wanted something good to come from that awful loss. So I joined Big Brothers and Big Sisters. And I was matched up with a little boy, Hispanic little boy, whose father had just died of AIDS 6 months earlier before our match. And his mother was in the final stages of succumbing to AIDS. And before then, I had never seen, I walked into the house, I'll never forget it, she was bedridden right off to the side. I'd never seen anyone with full-blown AIDS in the final stages. And that, you know, I didn't know how to process that. And that really kind of broke and scratched my record in a way that I was like, I couldn't reconcile the fact that, you know, I was 24 years old, I had, you know, graduate degree, no debt, I had my car, I had freedom to mobility, all this. And this little boy would bury both of his parents before his 9th birthday, through no fault of his own, growing up in poverty 6 blocks away from one of the world's most prestigious universities. And I realized at that point, I wanted to do something that could work towards decreasing, in my own way, reducing inequality. And the party that wants to accomplish that would be my party, and clearly that's driven by, yeah, the Republicans. That's kind of a false choice, really, for Republicans. You know, they're much, unfortunately, much more about inequality. They thrive on that inequality, and that was that start, and now that brought me to Braddock, and that brings me to running for mayor, to the Senate, and it brings me to standing in front of this room right now.
An incredible story, and I'm glad that you chose to do something as positive as you did with that opportunity. So,
yeah, thank you.
So, a lot of your work as the mayor of Braddock focused on bringing new life to the community. When people think of bringing back a Rust Belt town, they don't generally think of community gardens and artist collectives. What was the inspiration for your approach with it?
Well, I mean, the core there is, it was a balanced approach. Now, I mean, gentrification is an important topic, and you know, you can't really talk about urban renewal without addressing that and being mindful of that. In a community where 90% of the population left, gentrification isn't really an issue. Abandonment, wholesale, widespread abandonment is the issue. So we went about doing things in a balanced manner. We had aspirational goals, but we also had fundamental and important basic goals. I wouldn't want a brewery to open in town before we had a community center for our young people. I wouldn't be worried about having a restaurant in a town that never had it, that doesn't have a restaurant, without having a great summer youth program. I can't worry about any of these other aspirational things if Braddock is still a disproportionately violent and dangerous place. And we can't do that, we can't achieve that through a harsh, overbearing police philosophy. So I think we created a really great community policing model that enabled us to go 5.5 years without the loss of life in our community. And that benefits everybody, and we didn't generate the complaints and things of that nature. Who here is familiar with the name Antoine Rose? Yeah, Antoine Rose. Antoine Rose was actually featured in my campaign video for Senate in 2016. He actually appeared in it. My wife, Giselle, who couldn't be here today, was asked by the family to speak at his funeral. I mean, that's the level of engagement that we have within that in that community. So it was a balanced one. Yeah, it's great that Anthony Bourdain came to our restaurant. Yeah, it's great that it was picked one of the top 10 best new restaurants in America. But what's really great and what's really important is that we have a police department that has created a safer community where young people and others aren't losing their lives through senseless violence, and did it in a way that's constructive and supportive of the community, not oppressive especially racially biased the way you see it all across the country play out. I fundamentally believe that a police officer's most powerful weapon is his or her discretion. It's not their gun or their taser. It's that moment where he or she decides, okay, this person didn't use a turn signal. Do I have to escalate this? You know, this person's selling loose cigarettes. Do I have to escalate this? This person is running away. Do I have to put 3 bullets in his back? You know, like, you know, we there's some things that we need to address, and then there's some things as a policing philosophy, I believe, you know, if they're running away, arrest them another day, you know, these kind of things. So it's always been about balance in that. And that's what I would always want it to be that way. We've had some really great successes entrepreneurial, but my wife just opened up an incubator in town last month that features and hosts 6 African-American women entrepreneurs from the Braddock area as well, too. And they pay, I think, $150 a month in rent, just very, very basic to operate out of. So it's really about a balanced approach.
So this is kind of shameful admission time. A lot of our listeners and possibly some hosts of our podcast didn't actually know what the lieutenant governor did until Pasquale, who interned in the lieutenant governor's office, actually explained it to us.
When you win, if you need someone on the ground immediately, I got it.
But one of your duties would be presiding over the state Senate, which has got a Republican supermajority right now. Mm-hmm. The last time Democrats controlled both houses of the General Assembly at the same time was 93, and that's because one dude switched parties because he was big mad. How important is it to you and Governor Wolf that we get good, qualified, progressive Democrats elected to both houses?
I mean, it's issue number one. And there's so many great candidates out there, too. And if there's ever a year to do it, it's this year. And we need to win as many races as we can, so it's impossible to overstate how important that is. And there's such great candidates too. Like, I'm so proud to be a Democrat. One of the best things about going around to all these different counties is meeting the people that are running, you know. And they're the kind of people you want to be friends with. They're kind of the people you want to have a beer with. The ones that you want to live next to. Those are the kind of folks. And it's like, to me, that's what Democrats are. You know, that we are worried and preoccupied with the collective good, not how much I can get for myself. And I think that message would play and should play in more districts despite being gerrymandered, and I'm optimistic in 2020 after the census, and we can get fair districts, not gerrymandered in our direction, fair, like the congressional districts are now. You know, and let me go off on a little bit of a rant there on the congressional districts. Does anybody know if the new map was in place in 2016, what the RD breakdown would have been?
It would have been 66% Republican, despite only getting about 50%
of the vote for 2/3 of the seats.
No, the Republicans would have had 10 seats, and we would have had 8 under the new map, which is reflects the will of the Pennsylvania voter in that election. And the Democrat, you know what the Democrats do? They wanted to impeach the Supreme Court for that map. And you want to know why? Because they don't want fair. They want it all, you know? Hell, they're not even happy with 13 and 8 and 5, you know? They want it all. And that's the difference between our party. We want fair, you know? And you know what? If Pennsylvania votes 10 Republicans and 8 Dems, I mean, I don't like that, but at least that's the will of Pennsylvania voters. You know, but in this election, we're going to get a whole slew of women in our congressional delegation, which is amazing. And we are going to have a balance that reflects the will of Pennsylvania voters. And I'm really, really optimistic that we will have that same thing in our state and House, our state and Senate, you know, through the redistricting process in 2020. But in the meantime, we have some amazing and really wonderful candidates in Pennsylvania up and down the whole ballot.
So this year is very interesting because you're running on a ticket with an incumbent governor, Tom mm-hmm. Wolf. What is something that you believe Governor Wolf has done very well in his first term, and is there something you would consider pushing him to do in his second term or doing something differently?
I think Governor Wolf's done a lot of really amazing things in his first term. 750,000 Pennsylvanians have health care now because of him. That's pretty good. Governor Wolf is the firewall. They've had two bills that would have essentially outlawed abortion or just all effectively. And Governor Wolf was like, boom, you know, right back in the face.
Full Matumbo.
Yeah. You know, protecting labor, restoring the cuts in education, balancing the budget, depositing for the first time in, I think, 10 or 12 years, that a $22 million deposit in the rainy day account. In all kinds of investments, the first LGBTQ commission in all of Pennsylvania. And I'm not pushing Governor Wolf on LGBTQ issues, but I want to see equal protection for everybody in the next term. I would very much like to see we move towards legalizing marijuana, you know, in Pennsylvania as well. I would very much like to see us change the majority, or back to majority from unanimous for the parole and pardon, for pardons. These are just kind of common sense, practical things that I don't see it as pushing anybody on our side. I see it as bringing the Republicans around to say, you know, if the morality doesn't move you, the dollars and cents should. You know, can't we just agree on that? You know. I don't want to sound cornball, but I'm proud to be his running mate, because I don't think Governor Wolf because he's so humble and so unassuming. He doesn't, I think, in some cases get the kind of credit and recognition he deserves for doing the great job that he's done on a lot of different issues, especially considering the deck is badly stacked against him through gerrymandering, you know. So
yeah, I'm gonna kind of edit on the fly a little bit here, because that kind of you touched on the next question that we actually had, which was fantastic. But something that's especially sort of in strong relief, you know, you won your first mayoral election in 2005 by a single vote.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
When you hear somebody, especially a younger voter, say, "Oh, why did my vote doesn't matter?" How do you personally react to that? How does that, like?
Well, I tell them that story if they listen. Like, and when you win by one vote, you know, like, I know, for example, I know a young person that came through my GED program. We got him a job at Lowe's Home Improvement. I know that he left work on his lunch break to vote for me that day. I know that. And he was late getting back, and his manager was pissed and docked him 2 hours pay. And if he could have said, yeah, John, I voted for you, I never would have known, you know? But if he didn't do that, I wouldn't be standing in this room right now today, you know? And I never forget that, you know? And that's, on a bigger level, but still small, Connor Lamb, how many votes did he win by? 650 out of over 200,000? Hillary lost by 44,000 votes? It's all about a vote, you know? And I can honestly tell you, true as it is as I'm standing here, that but for one single solitary vote, I would have never had a career in public service the way I've had. And to anyone that thinks their vote doesn't count, you know, I want to be the person that tries to convince you otherwise. And not only does your vote count, but all your friends and relatives that don't care, that don't participate, that think it's not important, it's incumbent on you to rally them and say that it does matter and it does make a difference.
So we are here at the PA Young Dems Convention. And what are the types of things that you would see you being able to do to keep us engaged now through November and then onward?
Well, if I am lucky enough to be your next lieutenant governor, active engaged to me extends, more importantly, after if we win, you know, and coming to all your events as much as I can and saying, hey, stop on by the office. Hey, I want to hear what's on your mind. I want to listen to these kind of concerns. It's not like, got what we need, check you 3 years from now or 3.5 years when we need you. That's not what this is about. This is about, you know, acknowledging that we need to have an open, ongoing dialogue, both online through social media, Facebook, what have you, and also in person. You know, we try to go to as many events as we physically can. You know, Bobby's always rolling his eyes at me. I'm like, Bobby, can we do this? Bobby, can we do this? And, you know, he has to keep the schedule and keep me, you know, from saying yes to everything. And we try to say yes to everything. And being here is another example of that. Like, and we have how many more events with Young Dems? We have York, right? We have Indiana. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. There's three in the. We're in Philadelphia. We're going to the one. Yeah, later. Yeah, Philadelphia. I don't hold. Yeah, I mean, so that's what I mean. Where it's sincere, because that's the only thing that's ever changed is a new generation of leadership coming up and saying, this is unacceptable. It should be about this. You know. So I ask you, take me at my word on that. If you're a young voter, or if you're skeptical, or whatever, it's just something that will always be important.
We certainly will take you at your word.
All right. So the final question is going to be a two-parter, and I kind of just edited it a little bit. only because this is very personal for me, as being accused of only wearing quote summer wear.
Renaissance man.
bathing suit, flip-flops, and a tank top. So since you are not a fan of wearing a suit, have you chosen a formal work shirt for your inauguration? And the second part is, if you do wear a suit, what kind of tattoo are you making Governor Wolf get?
Yeah, well, the good news is we've already had talks about doing a second commercial, you know. If anyone's seen the one where he takes me tie shopping, you know. I was worried when we were filming that because I was like, well, who's going to get the, you know, Sunny reference? So if we get Governor Wolf some ink, you know, who knows? You know, I don't know. this is how I like to dress. You know, this is how, this is who I am. Young people can smell that a mile away. You ever see a candidate, you could just tell they went to Cabela's or some store and they still have the, they forget to take the tags off and they show up and they try to be every man when they show up and be like, yes, 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 tell me. Or they'll have a suit on and they'll just roll their sleeves up just enough to show that they're, you know, getting down to business or whatever. I'm like, this is who I am, you know, like this is what I, you know, dress like, you know, for, you know, good or bad, you know, I've had people say, get a suit for God's sakes, you bum. I my car parked out in the lot. It's a Ford F-150. I mean, this is, I do have a suit. I do have a suit. I had to get one for the campaign. Thank you. I'm estranged from it. You know, I will say that I am estranged. We don't visit often together. If you wearing shorts in the winter, to me, that's genius. You know, like that's, I'm all about, you know, that if possible. But I think what's less important than what you wear, it's what you stand for, you know? And when I was in a suit and a tie, I said, I'm not any more progressive. It doesn't make me any more, you know, it doesn't change anything other than the wrapper, basically, you know? If somebody needs to see me in a suit before they vote for me or whatever, all right, I'll put on a suit. But I think it is more important to just say, like, this is who I am, you know.
That was perfect.
All right. So, yeah, I know we had a couple of questions out in the audience, I think. Did anybody have one they wanted to throw out there? Anybody? By all means.
Okay, so I live in Lancaster County, and I go out and do a lot of canvassing on behalf of the Poor Baby campaign.
You have a fantastic slate of candidates, like Jess King.
You do have Jess King, yeah. Jess is amazing. But my question is actually specifically an issue that gets brought up a lot when I'm representing you at the door.
Mm-hmm.
I hear a lot, oh yeah, I really want to support Fetterman, except for his stance on fracking.
Mm.
And so I know there was a particular issue that, situation that happened, and I would just love maybe if you could explain
sure.
that a little bit so that I am able to represent it better.
Yeah. For starters, I have, in both of my races, I signed the no accepting no zero fossil free fossil fuel dollars. You know, I've never taken a dollar from the industry. I'm not a fan of the industry. I'm not for expanding it. I'm not for taking it into virginal forest lands. I'm not for any of that stuff. I think we have to have, where it exists currently right now, we have to have the most stringent environmental regulations and controls. We absolutely deserve and must enact an extraction tax as well, too, on that. It's absurd. The pizza that you bought for your meeting, you paid tax on that. These gas companies taking your natural resources don't pay tax on that, and it doesn't benefit anybody. That's unfair. The situation that you're referencing was about this time a year ago, U.S. Steel and the union summoned local leaders to have a meeting saying the viability of the mill in our town, which is the last steel mill in western Pennsylvania, is really in jeopardy. And we have devised a way that if we drill two wells on the site's property, which it's not in my community, it's in two or three communities down the line, and produce our own natural gas, we would be able to guarantee that, all but guarantee that the mill's future for the next 20 plus years, 20, 25 years. And that's connected to two other facilities in the region. So that you're talking 3,000 union jobs, 3,000 union jobs. And I said, that's a compelling reason. Two wells that are sitting atop over a mile of bedrock, so there'll be no groundwater contamination or anything, to save 3,000 union family-sustaining jobs and a way of life, I think makes sense, you know. And I didn't shy away from that. And some opponents tried to paint me as pro-fracking and all this. I was like, no. And some people are like, well, tough luck for them. They should learn coding and they should do something else. And I'm like, I don't think that's right. I think it's like these steel workers and their families deserve to have an element of economic security. So the decision isn't mine. It was really just me coming down when asked, you know, where do you come down on that? And I'm not going to stand up in front of a room full of steel workers, 3,000, and their families saying, my absolute ban on all fracking is not more important than your ability to provide for your family and your economic security of your towns and your home. And that's where that arose from. And then it turned into this pro-fracking. So, Mike, all our reports are online. We didn't take a single dime. We got a check, Bobby, what was it, either $5,000 or $10,000? Yeah, from somebody associated with the industry, and we sent it back, you know. We've never taken a dollar. We never will take a dollar from the industry, you know, because I don't want anyone saying I made a decision based on money that I received, you know. I would support that based exclusively on preserving the way of life and the economic security of 3,000 union jobs and their families. And let me just say, if somebody is an absolutist and thinks that I'm wrong, I would just ask them if we could just agree to disagree on that. And I would hope they wouldn't withhold their support from a ticket that, you know, that I think, you know, is infinitely better than the other side. You know, I think when the race comes down to one and two choices, I think we have an obligation as citizens to vote for the best one, not the perfect one, in their estimation. You know, so to anyone that would say that to you at the door, with my respects, it's 3,000 families, and it's not a let them eat cake situation. There's no one in Allegheny County that lives closer to that mill than I do, and I have three young kids under the age of 9. You know, it's not like I'm living in some mansion, you know, removed, and I'm like, yeah, whatever. It's like live across the street from the mill. And to those that know Braddock or the area, know that that's absolutely true. Yes. It's there's things that I would never compromise on, and there's things that you have to compromise on. You know, if the Republicans said that we want to restrict a woman's right to access in Pennsylvania, there's no compromise on that. If we think that we don't think unions have a right to exist and organize, there's no compromise on that. You know, but if we want to argue about film tax credits, I'm very much for them. If they're, it's deliberative, you know, and that's where it comes down to having a set of core progressive bedrock principles that we, you know, that I wouldn't deviate from on those.
Hey, John.
Yes.
Hi, John. My name is Lawrence. I used to live in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. I worked for the steelworkers. Yeah. So I met you outside the Edgar Thompson plant.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so my question is very kind of Western PA-centric. So UPMC has been in a lot of trouble with the state. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They tried to get rid of any patients, including Medicare eligibles, who did not have a UPMC health plan to get anyone who was on Blue Cross Blue Shield to switch over, went to the PA Supreme Court. Your town in particular, I went online and I saw UPMC Braddock that closed down.
Yep.
In the last decade. I'm very lucky. I live in Philadelphia now. I lived in Pittsburgh before. Plenty of hospitals nearby, but a lot of the Commonwealth doesn't have that easy access. Yep. And they're driving an hour to get into Pittsburgh, or an hour to get into for the kind of care that they need. What are some ways that you think that Tom Wolf's office can kind of better regulate UPMC and other healthcare providers in a way that hasn't been done before?
I mean, to me, I'm very eager to become Lieutenant Governor to have the bully pulpit the office affords. Most recently, about 6 weeks ago, I headlined a protest in UPMC McKeesport for the nurses union. You know, UPMC is trying to screw them out of it. And we held a rally, and 2 weeks later, they got a fair contract. You know, using that, you know, I always tell people, especially in your part of the state, if you haven't heard of UPMC, give it another couple years and you will. They're literally trying to take over the healthcare market. And I've seen the business, harsh business end of UPMC firsthand in my community. In fact, it kind of all started there, you know. And the platform of Lieutenant Governor, I think that's what that's really, I'd want to make sure. I mean, I personally, you know, Mr. Romoff makes $7 million a year. Yeah, that's a lot of money. But, you know, they still don't pay their workers a minimum of a living wage. Like, I couldn't pay myself $7 million and know that the people that make this work and run are not able to take care of themselves and their family in a safe manner. You know, I don't know how you do that. And that's part about holding them accountable. And that's one of the reasons why I want to use this office to do just that.
All right. Thank you so much, Mayor John Fetterman. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
So, everyone, we're going to take a 5-minute break.